This is Laurie Lewis, Little Comrades, Chapter 35, Mulberry Street. The afternoon after my Times Square date with Sol, Ellen and I took the crosstown bus and walked a few blocks to Mulberry Street to see the new apartment. Well, fancy that. Here we were back in Little Italy again. Not far north of our first apartment on Grand Street. This was our fifth apartment in just over a year. We were happy to discover some downward mobility and then a little upward. After our fifth floor walk up, then the basement park, we found the ground floor on Mulberry Street. It was a small building, only two floors. The landlord occupied the upstairs apartment. The living room had a fireplace. Not to be used, the landlord said. Oh well, it looked pretty. Irving and Henrietta generously offered to give back those chairs we'd so lovingly painted. We found an old dining table. We built a bookcase to fill one wall. It was easy. Ellen ordered the planks cut to size. All we had to do was hammer in some nails. As soon as we put the books in, the bookcase collapsed. We sat on the floor amid a mountain of books, laughing till we cried. Home again. At Christmas, my mother invited Sol for Christmas dinner. She was still checking him out, really. He was a lot older, about halfway between my age and Ellen's, and perhaps Ellen hadn't figured out what he saw in me beyond the obvious. At the point, I hadn't either. What I saw in him was a warm, cuddly guy, very polite and very smart. Ellen had bought a small chicken for the three of us, so we both had a moment of panic when Sol showed up with a friend in town, Leslie, one of his colleagues. "Are you sure you don't mind?" Sol asked. I knew Ellen wouldn't turn him away. Christmas dinner would certainly be more interesting with two men and two women, which might have been what had prompted Sol to bring him along. Perhaps Sol was nervous about making conversation with my mother all evening. Ellen thought the little chicken could be stretched, and Leslie contributed a bottle of wine, so that was a bonus. This was long before Dr. Seuss made Mulberry Street famous and long before the area became trendy Soho. In 1947, it was Little Italy, a neighborhood of mama and papa bakeries, butchers and grocery stores, with a few small Italian restaurants, affordable and homey. In summer and fall, every few weeks brought a saint's day and its obligatory street fair, when the penetrating aromas of sausage and garlic, of onions and tomatoes and peppers spread through the area from the street vendors. Rotund politicians made speeches from the bandstand. Big L from Chicago. Why here? Who knew? It had some kind of New York logic. Robust opera singers launched aching arias over the heads of the crowd long into the night. Lights flashed, music soared over the tenements. Someone played an accordion on a fire escape. People milled about in the streets, jostling each other, eating, dancing, playing games. We loved every minute of it. We didn't have much money, but we managed. That was what we said all the time. We'll manage. Here in a low building on Mulberry Street, technically not a tenement, we had two large rooms with a small room like a hallway separating them. This is what New York called a railway apartment, named for the long line of rooms, each leading into the next. The living room at the front faced the street, with a charming but non-functioning fireplace on the outer wall. Ellen's bed, as always, doubled as a couch, and making a successful repair, we had built rather rudimentary bookcases in the alcoves on each side of the fireplace. From the large kitchen at the back, a pair of tall windows gave a view of the caboose, a backyard full of broken boxes and machine parts. The hallway between the two rooms was on one side my bedroom and on the other side our closet, where coats and dresses hung on walls beside a low chest of drawers. Some time ago, the City of New York Building Code had decreed that bathtubs must be provided for tenants. Throughout the city, the landlords had responded by installing bathtubs as simply and cheaply as possible in the kitchen right next to the sink. There is nothing quite like a bathtub to provoke thoughts of nakedness. It's quite possible that these new bathtubs were responsible for the greatly increased birth rate in Manhattan the following year. Ellen and I found it all hilarious. The usual slab of wood provided useful workspace when the tub was not occupied by a naked body. After I left for school in the mornings, Ellen would lift the slab off the tub, climb over the curled edge, and find herself looking at a kitchen sink full of breakfast dishes. To our friends from Canada, the bathtub lent a certain bohemian air. Visitors were all uncomfortably eager to bathe. Less charming was the unheated toilet out in the hall, where we had installed a strategically placed heat bulb to be activated when the room was occupied. In our living room on Christmas Day, Ellen and I sat with Saul and Leslie, telling them the story of making our collapsible bookcases and trying to put Leslie at ease. When the phone rang, it was at least a happy distraction, a friend of Ellen's from work. Her family visit to Syracuse had turned unpleasant and Nona was now at Grand Central on her way to visit us. Today? Yesterday. Now. For Christmas. Wasn't that exciting? Well, one girl. Perhaps she has a small appetite, said Ellen. Nona had no sooner arrived that the doorbell rang. There, on the doorstep, stood Reuben and Pearl, old party friends of Ellen's from Toronto. They'd come to New York to visit Rube's uncle. His rich uncle, they always said. But they'd forgotten how thrifty the rich can be. My uncle's house is colder than Canada, Ruby said. They knew they could get warm at our place. Hope we didn't find them inviting themselves. It was just as Ruby and Pearl arrived that the snow began. How simply marvelous, how picturesque. A white Christmas. Everyone rushed to the living room window to watch the lovely soft flakes drifting down. A cocker spaniel puppy was ecstatic. All those faces to lick. A cat suddenly retreated on the couch from where she stared out through the forest of legs. We also had a visiting cat for the holidays. The poor thing had holed up in the corner and made herself as invisible as possible, hoping to escape the notice of our own cat, who glared at her, growling evilly. The snow was coming down more heavily now. Beautiful big snowflakes. In the kitchen, Ellen and I took inventory of the pantry. There was a can of tomato soup. We have that to start with, stretching it for 7 people. And that pathetic chicken she'd bought to serve 3 people was now, like the biblical loaves and fishes, somehow going to have to satisfy the hunger of the multitude. Ellen doubled the stuffing recipe, using up the last of a loaf of bread. I cut up great quantities of vegetables, lots and lots of mashed potatoes, lots and gravy. Ellen always made marvelous gravy, carameled and rich. We'd get by somehow. And we had the Christmas pudding and some fruit cake that my grandmother had sent from Calgary. The snow showed no sign of stopping. It was exquisite in the view from the windows. The backyard behind the kitchen relinquished its chaos to the serenity of a snowy blanket. We pulled chairs and boxes from everywhere and all of us managed to sit at the kitchen table, having a merry old time. Reuben and the Pearl and Ellen talked about friends and politics back in Toronto. Nona and Leslie very willingly shared a chair, and Sol and I nuzzled at each other right in front of my mother. We didn't have enough plates, of course, or glasses or cups, but we improvised. And Leslie's bottle of wine just nicely served all of us, even me, and I wasn't even of legal drinking age. And outside in the darkness, the snow fell gracefully. The radio told us where we were in the middle of what was undoubtedly going to be the heaviest snowfall in New York's history. Cars clogged the streets, buses and taxis had stopped running, even the subways had stopped. The radio warned everyone, stay where you are, wherever you are, just stay there. Our visitors had no way of getting to their homes, wherever those homes might be. We were stuck with them. They were stuck with us. We were among friends. What more could we want on Christmas Day, sitting on the floor in the living room with fruit and cake and coffee, warm and full of good, full of food. Full of food. We had two beds, counting the one doubling as a couch in the living room. Seven people had to sleep somewhere, or at least lay their heads down for some part of the night. My mother claimed the right to sleep alone and in her own bed. Rube and Pearl suggested they take the kitchen floor, using cushions and coats for padding. Nona and I giggled at the thought of the one bed left, the four people. Sol and Leslie looked at the ceiling. The four of us bedded down horizontally across my bed in the hallway. There wasn't much sleeping done that Christmas night. My mother pleaded desperately from time to time, would you people please settle down so I can get some sleep? Let people sleep who wanted to sleep, she said. Stop holding around. But to us, sleep was far less important than fun. In the kitchen, Rube lay on his back and snored serenely through it all. Now and then, Pearl gave him a punch and he'd snuddle. That would start us off giggling again, giggling and groping under the blankets, whispering perfectly safe in a crowd. And intermittently throughout the night, the visiting cat would venture out of a corner, hoping to sneak into the kitchen for food. Our cat stalked her, and the puppy followed, eager to see what was going on. Pet pandemonium, snarling and snapping, sniveling and cringing, yelping and hissing. In the morning, the snow was still coming down. All through Manhattan, not a wheel was turning. Hills of snow marked the location of abandoned cars lining the curbs, and some in the middle of streets. The radio announced that there would be no deliveries to stores throughout the area. No bread and milk, no meat, no anything. And in our small apartment on Mulberry Street, seven hungry people awoke yawning and hoping somehow to be given food and sustenance. This was before everyone had a freezer. Most people bought their food on a day-to-day basis and kept a few canned things for emergencies. Our cupboard was bare, and Ellen had no money anyway. The stores weren't even going to bother to open the doors, the radio said. Ellen made coffee and called a conference around the kitchen table. She was not only the oldest adult and official proprietor of the house, but she was used to taking charge in times of hunger, a holdover from her depression days. She suggested we deploy two foraging teams. Each would explore the surrounding streets in the hope of finding an open store. Tactfully, Sol said we'd need to take up a collection to see what money we had for food. A dollar here, a dollar there, a few stray quarters, enough for eggs, milk, bread and butter. Rube and Pearl stayed with Ellen to talk about the political situation in Canada, a bit tense these days of spy stories. Leslie and Nona went westwards with orders from Ellen to send a runner back to her at Mulberry Street in 50 minutes to report the findings. After a cozy night under the blankets, they were happy to go off to find their own way of improving the morning. Good spirits prevailed. Sol and I bundled up and plodded off toward Third Avenue, plowing through snow that came up above our knees. Calm, white avenues opened in magical silence before us. We walked in the middle of the street through the unblemished snow. New York had never looked so clean, so pure, had never been so quiet. The bars were dark, the pawn shops closed, the office buildings and bridal shops lifeless, and Grazia Molto Grazia, a welcoming opening sight, glowed from a corner daily.